Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama is in Oslo today to collect his Nobel Peace Prize. In his speech, he pointedly focused on others doing humanitarian work day in and day out, grappling down in the weeds with hard problems. That's our focus today. An extraordinary medical missionary doing his work for the uninsured and untreated in this country. Former Los Angeles gang members bringing hope to young men without means in Alabama. This hour, On Point, extraordinary people doing extraordinary things for others right now. You can join the conversation. What do you make of these stories of people reaching out beyond themselves? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We look today first at an unusual intervention in an impoverished community in Alabama by former gang members from Los Angeles. Joining us right now from Mobile, Alabama, first, John Eads. He's executive director and co-founder of the Light of the Village Christian Community and has been working with kids for 8 years in Alabama Village in the city of Pritchard, on the border there of Chickasaw, Alabama, and Mobile, Alabama. It's known as maybe the most dangerous neighborhood in South Alabama. John Eads, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
And joining us from Mobile is Decino Dees. He's a 17-year-old resident of Alabama Village. Before getting involved with John Eads, he was living on the streets. He's now in school. Decino Dees, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And with us one more from Los Angeles, California, Agustin Lizama, a former gang member. He's now a senior navigator with Homeboy Industries, which helps former gang members and at-risk youth with job placement and training and education. In 2007, he took his first trip to Pritchard, Alabama, to mentor teenagers there. Agustin, welcome to On Point. Thanks a lot for being here.
Okay, hello. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you all with us. We heard about your story from a report in the Los Angeles Times, and it really caught our eye. John Eads, why did you set out to bring these two communities of young men together?
Well, it started about 8 years ago. We started a little Christian ministry there in Alabama Village, and I was a healthcare executive at the time. My wife taught school full-time, and as the ministry grew, we decided that we needed to really, or I especially decided, I really needed to learn more about gang intervention. And so I did a web search and found that Homeboy Industries out in Los Angeles, California, is considered the nation's best practice. And after I left the healthcare field, I decided to go out there and just see what they were doing and actually live with them, learn more about the whole gang society, but more importantly, learn more about how to help prevent and intervene in that same society.
Tell us a little bit more about Alabama Village. I'm looking here at some statistics on violent crime, for example, far above the U.S. average and far above the Alabama average, nearly double.
Yeah, Tom, it is rough. It started in the 40s as they built a lot of little houses to help house the shipbuilders that came into Mobile during the 40s, during the war. And it was a, you know, kind of a barrack-style community, a lot of, you know, wooden single-story buildings. And over the years, it started to become more Section 8 housing in the 80s and the 90s. And it has then descended into where it is now. And even at our little place, we were able to get a place right in the middle of the village, which we really felt that's what Christ wanted us to do, you know, be right there so we could be available and do work there and do service there and show love there. And it is pretty rough. We've had 38 people shot within 200 yards of our building since we've been there. And it's pretty tough place. At the same time, though, Tom, we've seen a lot of beautiful things as well.
We're going to talk about those.
Keeps us going.
We're going to talk about those. But poverty and crime, serious enough to impress even fairly hardened gang members or one-time gang members from Los Angeles. Here's a little tape of Luis Colicchio, who was in Alabama Village, Pritchard, Alabama, former gang member, now with Homeboy Industries, like Agustin Lizama. He's talking here about his first impressions of Alabama Village, a tough neighborhood in the city of Pritchard, Alabama.
How can I say? I don't know. I've never seen a place like this, you know? So I really, it's hard for me to kind of describe it, but it's like a third world country, you know?
And here's 11-year-old Tyler Moore of Pritchard, Alabama, talking with the LA Times about his neighborhood.
shooting, raping, stealing, breaking in people's houses, robbing stores. Just doing everything you can mention in the book. I just don't like living in a neighborhood like this. It feels scary and frightening, and it's like you need protection around here.
11-year-old there, Tyler Moore of Alabama Village, Alabama. Augustine Lizama joins us from Los Angeles. He's with Homeboy Industries there, former gang members looking to mentor others out of that life. Augustine, when did you first go to Alabama Village, and what was your impression of what you found there, sir?
I believe it was May of 2007. I was pretty much, I was speechless when I first drove to the neighborhood of Pritchard.
Why?
Just by what I've seen. I've never seen poverty like this in my life, and I grew up in poverty, and it really hit me in my heart, because it made me see that I actually had it good in my poverty than what these kids have it on. So even afterwards, when we got home that night at Mr. John's house, Mr. Eat's house, I was even in tears that night in my room.
And you were someone who'd been in a gang for 13 years in Los Angeles. You knew the tough side of Los Angeles, which certainly has poverty and problems of its own.
Yes, I've been in the streets gang banging since the age of 12. This was in 1991. Actually, that's when I first experienced my first gunshot to my arm. So, yes, I've been through it all, and I was one of the worst of the worst. So,
what did John Eads ask you to do in Alabama?
Nothing. He just when I first met him, all he was asking was for guidance, and I think ever since then we built a relationship, and I'm very sure it was a connection from God, because ever since then our relationship just started building, and he was just asking me for guidance and to go to Pritchard, Alabama, and see if I could touch people over there and these kids and what I could do. And I'm just trying to, and what I did was I'm trying to work my magic, because I have all this experience in the gang world, in the gang culture, which I used to use to negativity, which I'm now this day I'm trying to use it in positive.
John Eads, what did you hope that these former gang members from Los Angeles would do for the young men in Pritchard, Alabama, on the streets?
I think, number one, earn credibility with them. But that was just initially. Then I wanted them to really develop relationships, both with them and, like Augustine said, with me as well, as the person here full-time, me and my wife. And all that has come to pass. And the neat thing is even though they're Hispanic, a lot of the, our community is pretty much African-American, mm-hmm. and a lot of the boys were saying, oh, they don't have anything to tell us. And my suggestion to them was just listen to what they have to say. And ever since that, it's become like a family. It's like a kinship that doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but again, in God's world, it does, and it's just so awesome to see. And what they've done is they've been able to develop relationships with the kids. They'll call and ask about a certain kid, and that relationship is just fantastic, Tom.
Decino Dees, you're 17 years old. You live in Alabama Village. You heard Tyler Moore describing the problems there. Is that the way you see it? Do you see the crime and poverty around you that Tyler was describing, Decino? Is that all familiar to you? Is that your town?
Yes, sir.
Just as tough as that.
Yes, sir.
When you were 10 years old, I'm reading here, you were stealing, skipping school, running with a bad crowd. What has it meant for you to talk with the guys from Los Angeles who were former gang members coming in to say, don't do it? Has it helped change your life, Decino?
Well, I knew if they can change, I know I can change, because some of the stuff they've been through, I've been through it too.
Is it tempting for young men in Alabama Village to get into a gang-style life, Decino?
It's very tempting, because your friends, they try to persuade you to do the stuff, but sometimes you just got to lay back and let them do what they do.
Has it made it, have the guys from L.A. made it cool not to get in the gang by what they've told you and taught you?
Yes, because their stories kind of sound something like our story.
Augustine, what do you tell them when you get together with the guys in the Pritchard and you're trying to steer them away from what must be incredibly tempting, given the poverty they're surrounded by? What do you tell them to steer them in another direction?
You know, I concentrate a lot on my experience. For one thing, I know this lifestyle, there's two destinations to it. And one of them is eventually you're going to end up in prison for the rest of your life, or you're going to end up in a buried somewhere in a cemetery one day. So what I just tell them is my story, the guys I grew up with, how many guys ain't here no more that I wish they were, right? I tell them that that could have been one of me, because I've been on both, I've already experienced both those experiences. So my experience has a lot to do with that, to try to touch these kids over there in Alabama.
Was it a problem? You're Hispanic. They're mainly African-American. Did you feel them looking at you at first like, what do you have to tell us? Or did you have more in common?
I had more in common. I knew that was coming. Of course, I had my faith in God because he was walking with me in that direction. So I knew because everything else that, like the family structures and all that, we all pretty much experienced the same thing. So I had something in common with it, and I could relate to them in a lot of ways.
But, you know, it occurs to me that you can give them a lot of guidance and a lot of advice, but it's hard to fix the poverty. Do you feel sometimes like you're sailing against the wind, given what they're up against, Augustine?
No, I have my faith that one day we'll be able to do that. I mean, I always tell Mr. John that, and Ms. Dolores, of course, that one day I can't wait to see Petra, Alabama, Light of the Village, make an example like Homeboys is down here in Los Angeles, or even a better example over there, as Homeboys doing here in Los Angeles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about extraordinary people diving in to tackle extraordinary problems, a long way from peace prizes or any kind of glory, looking at Alabama poverty, looking at America's health crisis later in this hour. We've been talking with three who have been working in Pritchard, Alabama, a tough town on the edge of Mobile and Chickasaw, Alabama, where young men have been tempted to a life of crime, a life, kind of gang life. John Eads there with the Light of the Village Christian Community reached out to former gang members in Los Angeles, Homeboy Industries in L.A. He got Augustine Lizama involved with young men like Decino Dees. They all join us. Augustine from L.A., Decino Dees and John Eads from Mobile, Alabama in this hour. We'll hear in just a moment from the mayor of Pritchard, Alabama, of what he thinks of the work that's being done there. And let me get a call right here from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Doug. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you.
I just have a question for these two guys that are helping the gangs out. I know that they said that poverty played a big role in it, but, I mean, you're going to have kids that are going to kind of long for that lifestyle, that rebellious lifestyle, and it's going to come from, you know, rich sections, too. And, you know, I mean, are they seeing a direct correlation mainly with poverty, or, you know, can you also relate it to the rich kids in the rich neighborhoods trying to get into the drugs and kind of leave that structured society to, well, like I'm saying, like the rebellious life?
Yeah, is it not just poverty that can put somebody on a tough path? Let us pick it up. John Eads, how about it? How big a role is poverty and a kind of, I mean, I've seen the streets in Pritchard. It is a tough scene there. Is it poverty that's driving this, or more, or something else?
I think overall it's a lack of faith, love, and hope, you know, which Paul writes about in the New Testament. But that crosses all lines. It crosses all racial lines, socioeconomic lines. And what Augustine has said is that no one joins a gang. They're running from something else to find something. And I think one of our first goals is to help fill that void and to, again, reflect true faith, love, and hope, of course, which we believe comes from Christ, but to actually make it real. And that does cross all those economic, you know, lines and so forth, and all the racial lines. One of the big questions we get is, you know, how are you accepted as a white guy over here? And it's not a problem because, again, the idea is that we're all searching for that. We're all searching for genuine faith, love, and hope. Once we find that, and once we help cure that, then the other things come, the education, the jobs, the poverty, and so forth. But if you have a kid, no matter what color, no matter how much money they have in their pocket, if they don't have faith, love, and hope, they're going to experience problems.
But a job helps too, and streets that are not blasted out as some of Pritchard's are, I mean, you must sometimes look at the economic situation that this population is and say, wow, you know, it's pretty tough to keep your chin up in that setting, John.
True. And one of the things we do in using the Homeboy Industry model is we'll take somebody like Decino as a good example, is we help them get an ID card. We help them get a job application, and then basically help them get a job, their first job, and help them get transportation to that job. It's funny. It's like there's no single answer to solve all the problems because they're all so intricate. There's transportation issues. There's people don't have birth certificates. People don't have these things. And it takes somebody to walk beside everybody, not look down at anybody, but walk side by side with them to help them get ID cards, Social Security cards, transportation, and make it happen. And while you're getting them, the end result is they get a job and have a little money in their pocket. The whole time we're building a relationship, we're building a kinship. Again, goes that faith, love, and hope. And it really is inspiring. And I have to say this, Tom, it's not just for those receiving, but it's for those of us that give as well. I mean, it's truly a beautiful thing.
Somebody to walk beside them, even if it's former gang members from Los Angeles, or maybe especially if, because they know something about streets like this. Though we heard Augustine, your colleague there, Louise, saying, "Wow, this is even beyond what he's known." I want to go to Alan in Richmond, Virginia. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I actually grew up in Mobile. Lived there till I was about 19 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I've done a lot of traveling around the country and even the world. And I just want to give a testament to really how bad the poverty is in Alabama Village. My older brother lived there for a little while, and just real rough neighborhood and in a real segregated town as well.
Yes. So you're not surprised that even these tough guys from L.A. are set back on their heels by what they find, what they see?
No, not at all. I've been through L.A. I've been through Watts. It is a pretty rough town, but it didn't shock me coming from where I came from.
Mm-hmm. But here's Pritchard working on its problems through the work of Homeboy Industries in L.A. and John Eads and others. Alan, thanks for your call. I want to hear directly from the mayor of Pritchard, Alabama, since 2004, Ronald Davis. He joins us from Pritchard. Mayor Davis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad I was able to join you all today.
Well, we are as well, and I wonder what you make of the work that John Eads is doing there and the guys coming in from Los Angeles. Did you wonder at first whether this was the missionary that you needed, the former gang members from Los Angeles, or did you see the sense of it?
Well, I did see the sense of it, and it was a great mission that John Eads has done over in Alabama Village. And John Eads and I have talked frequently about how we can change that community. Alabama Village is a very tough community. We are a city of 29,000 people, 85% African American, and over in that area, 50% of all police calls to that one particular area out of the whole city.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you a real idea of what type of activity that goes on in that community. And John Eads have really taken the bull by the horn, I could say, in that community, along with working with the police department and the city to make sure that these young guys understand that there are people out here that really love them and can work with them and give them hope and work with them to help educate themselves and bring it in the homeboys industry. And I have met with them every time that they have came into the city and talked to these young guys. I'm very pleased that they give these young men a sense of what real life is all about. If you take the direction that you are, or the path that you're on, this is the outcome that you're going to reap. Mm-hmm. And some of them have already experienced that at a young age, and this has done nothing but help them see that life can take you in other directions. This Alabama Village area is a part of our weed and seed area, and as the objective is to weed out the bad and seed in the good in that community, and it is a Department of Justice grant. And it's working. I am so pleased that what John Eads has done is turn the life around some of these individuals that need someone that really gives them a sense of ownership in their community. You find these young men out there now helping clean up that community.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the kind of thing that you want, where people have a sense of civil service. And they are learning all of these things, and he's helping them with their education, helping them learn more about computers and all of these things. So they are being groomed, well rounded, and then understanding that there is a God, that there are Christian values that help in these areas. And it makes a whole person. And when these young men get out here and understand that that they can be someone that can be a productive citizen and don't have to go the route that they have taken, mm-hmm. and knowing the outcome, when homeboys come in, it really gives them an outlook of what it would be 5, 6, 10 years down the road if I continue to go this route. And they have really brought a lot of an impact to the community. And we're going to continue to work with them. My goal is to revitalize that area, and I'm trying to get all of the assistance that I can along with what we already have. But we are headed in the right direction, and it is making a tremendous change in that community.
Mayor Davis, it's great to have you with us. I know we've got to let you go, but we're grateful that you've joined us today, and thank you very much for being there.
Well, thank you.
Mayor Ronald Davis of Pritchard, Alabama. Augustine Lizama in Los Angeles, must feel good to have the mayor look at the work you're doing there and be so grateful for it.
Yes, I met Mr. Mayor before Mr. Mayor Davis. He's a great guy. Yeah, it feels good to hear what he has to say about us and to actually him seeing the work we're actually doing over there with Mr. Eads and Mr. Loris at Light of the Village.
And what about your work with these young men? What does it mean to you? Do you get something back from it as well?
You know, spiritually, my soul, it enriches my soul, and spiritually it enriches me, all right? And that's the best feeling you could ever have in your life, because just by giving back, and I know that this is a calling for me that's been called from the man up above, and I'm just glad I'm fulfilling this calling.
Decino Dees, how are you looking at the future, my friend? What job would you like to do? You're 17. You're right on the edge of jumping out into the world. Are you thinking about getting more school or getting to work? What would you like to do with your life, Decino?
Well, I really don't have a plan for the future because things might come up. You might want to go a different path. So mm-hmm. I didn't really set a real goal for the future.
What about role models? Are these are the guys from Los Angeles giving you a sense of maybe not the job you want to do, but the way you want to be?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind going around talking to people or kids my age, telling them what I've been through, and so they don't have to go through it.
John, what about the economic opportunities for young men who may get on the right path, but, you know, to stay there, you've got to make a living?
Right, and one of the things, and I liked what Mayor Davis said, and I can't say enough good things about the mayor. He's been very supportive of us. Even before he was mayor, he looked at us with curiosity at first, but then because we stayed, and that's one thing that is important, is consistency and persistent, because you are going to have some bad days in this kind of ministry. You just are. And you're going to see a lot of things. But at the same time, you have to keep pressing on, and that's so important. And to answer your question, what we can see is kind of like what Decino said. We're keeping the options open. There could be opportunities that pop up that we are going to take advantage of, whether it be build a restaurant like they did at Homeboy Industries to help employ some of these guys and give them work experience and then let them go on, and let each one of these kids, again, let us all remember they're all individuals, and some of them, let them determine what their God-given talent is. And like Father Boyles and Homeboy says, let them see what God's path is for them. And then for us to be there to help support them, whether it be the GED, whether it be go to medical school, I don't know, whether it even be just stay, work with us to help continue the great work that, God has called us to do. It's it's full of opportunity, Tom, to be honest with you.
I understand that a lot of Pritchard came up pretty quickly after World War II, or maybe even during, to help support the shipbuilding industry in Mobile. Now, I don't know how much of that remains. Do you see big industries that could absorb these young men and put them productively to work around you right now?
There are several things they're working on with different contracts, with big government contracts, with tanker bids and so forth. They're going against Boeing right now to get one here locally. They've got ThyssenKrupp that's come in, and we've got a lot of opportunities. Since the Hurricane Katrina, a lot of things have moved on the Gulf Coast to the Mobile area, and that's been good. But in a way, for me, I look at them where they are and get the young person available for those opportunities. And that's kind of what I look at this point, is to give them that groundwork. Again, that faith, love, and hope, that confidence in themselves, first off, to just live life and not be tempted by the other side. But then, yeah, like you're saying, there is opportunities coming to this area. And again, the mayor's done a good job with that. And he's very optimistic with, you know, of the great things that can happen. And my goal, my job, is to make sure that, you know, again, we're led by God and make sure we take advantage of each opportunity so these kids can really just be fulfilled. That's our overall goal.
We've got a comment here at our website, On Point Radio, from Courtney. She says, hey, just want to say thank you for bringing the beauty of these individuals working for peace, hope, and love to the airwaves. People want to hear this kind of story. But Augustine, you're not naive. I mean, you must see in Pritchard, you know, there are young men, maybe men your age in their late 20s, who are in the life, of crime. They also are looking for recruits, I guess, here. Have you confronted them face to face?
I have. I have plenty of talks with some of the ones I know in Pritchard. But, you know, I even tell Mr. Eads that, you know, unfortunately, with this lifestyle, we're going to lose some of these kids and to prison or to death. But the good thing is we're going to also gain some of these kids. And that's the beauty of it, is gaining some of these kids. And, you know, there's going to be some kids that are going to go the wrong direction and do whatever they're going to do. And they're going to do prison terms, et cetera. So hopefully a lot of the village will be running up and strong, where when they're ready to really change their lives around, they'll have somewhere to go like we did at Homeboy Industries.
What about in the midst of all this? It may seem very far away, but President Obama certainly has put a new kind of face in the White House, and today he's in Oslo getting the Nobel Peace Prize. He said in his speech there, he said his accomplishments were slight, and he wanted to hold up, he said, those who toil in humanitarian organizations to relieve suffering, the unrecognized millions whose quiet acts of courage and compassion inspired even the most hardened of cynics. Is that you he's talking about, Augustine? Is that you?
I wouldn't know. That's just by thinking about it, I'm blushing right now, but no, I wouldn't know. I wish it is.
Does it make a difference that Barack Obama's in the White House or not? It's been a while now. The economy is not exactly great. Does just having a person of color there make a difference to you or the kids you're working with or not?
I believe it does. It shows that anything's possible. Nothing's impossible. Any human being could be anything they want, as long as they take that direction and they meet every standard that they need to. And so it throws up that hope out there to the world.
The CNODs, what about you? You're 17 years old in Alabama, Pritchard, Alabama. Does having a African-American president make a difference to you or not, sir? The CNO.
Yeah, it make a big difference for me, because then we know that if you want to be the president, you can be the president.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
That's pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward right there. John, what are the prospects for your work with Homeboy Industries? Is it going to go on? Do you have more coming in? Do you see them learning something about life from your streets in Alabama?
Sure. And first and foremost, let me go back to your other question to Augustine. Yes, Augustine is one of those that President Obama was talking about. And I would say DeSino is too. And I liked what the president said, because he's right. It's so interesting to see the people side by side we work with. So, yeah, the prospects are great, Tom, and we're going to keep pressing on. And we always be welcoming, even those guys coming out of prison. Everybody's welcome.
We're talking today about extraordinary people diving in to tackle extraordinary problems. It's been a real pleasure and privilege talking with all three of you. Augustine Lezama joined us today from Los Angeles. He's with Homeboy Industries there, a senior navigator mentoring at-risk youth. Augustine, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It was an honor and a privilege.
DeSino Dees, 17 years old, joined us from Mobile, Alabama, lives in Alabama Village. And DeSino, we wish you the very best of luck. Thank you for joining us, DeSino.
Thank you for having me.
John Eads, good luck with your work there, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it very much.
We've got more to come on the medical front. Stick with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about extraordinary people diving in to tackle extraordinary problems. We just heard about Alabama poverty and former Los Angeles gang members marshaled to help address and work with young men in that situation. We're talking now about America's healthcare crisis. And one angle on it of incredible effort. Stanley Brock was born in 1936 in the United Kingdom, South Wales, Wales, where he grew up. Spent 15 years of his early adulthood in the Amazon Basin. Became co-host of the NBC TV program Wild Kingdom in the 1960s. On a trek through the U.S. designing zoos, he landed in Knoxville, Tennessee, where in 1985 he founded Remote Area Medical. Originally to bring medical care to the remote Amazon, it now provides free medical care to thousands every year around the world and increasingly in the United States. You may have heard of the work of this former Amazon cowboy who's now out there putting together big volunteer weekend medical clinics around this country. Here's just a little bit of a report that 60 Minutes did back in 08, featuring Remote Area Medical, operating on that weekend in Knoxville, Tennessee. And Marty Tankersley was one of the hundreds of Americans who sought help at the clinic. Here it is, 5 a.m., and 60 Minutes reporter Scott Pelley found Marty in the parking lot waiting for Stanley Brock's clinic to open. He had a painfully infected tooth. He needed it pulled.
You drove 200 miles to get here?
Yes, sir.
And slept in this parking lot for 7 or more hours?
Yes, sir.
Just to have this done?
Yes, sir. I've been in some very excruciating pain.
The need is real. Stanley Brock and Remote Area Medical address it. He joins us now from Knoxville, Tennessee. Mr. Brock, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us how you put your clinics together. I know you do work abroad as well, but in the United States, it's sort of a couple of days of intense volunteer medical effort to serve all comers. How do you put together one of these sessions, Stanley?
We've been doing it now for so long. We've done 587 of these operations that it's really sort of runs on autopilot. It's certainly not rocket science. And we started the American program here around about 1992. And when we got a call from a remote and rather impoverished county here in Tennessee, where they just recently closed the hospital and lost their only dentist in the county. And so they asked if we could come up there and do something to help. And so we loaded a couple of dentists and a couple of 400-pound dental chairs in the back of a pickup and drove up to this place and was rather surprised to see quite a long line of people who needed to see a dentist. The sort of thing that we were very familiar with in the overseas environment. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another, and we've been just doing it in this country ever since, far more here than overseas. In fact, 64% of everything the Remote Area Medical does is done here in the United States now.
I'm looking at sessions that you set up in Utah and California and Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee. And from what I've seen, wherever you set these up and put the word out, hundreds and thousands of Americans show up, often sleeping overnight in a parking lot at a gate waiting to get in. With what range of problems and what range of services are you able to offer, Mr. Brock?
Well, the interesting thing is that although all of the people that come to our clinics really have a wide-ranging problems from smoking and diabetes and heart disease, high blood pressure, and so forth, they are overwhelmed with the pain from infected teeth, since they haven't been able to afford to go to the dentist for, in many cases, many, many years, and also their eyesight is failing them, and they need a pair of eyeglasses. So, typically, in one that we held just a few weekends ago in one of the rural counties, I was asked the same question when there were about 500 people outside the door at 5:30 in the morning. What are all these people here for? And I said, well, let me ask them. And I said, how many people are here to see the dentist? And every hand went up. How many people are here to see the eye doctor and get a pair of glasses? And every hand went up. How many people are here to see a medical doctor? And three hands went up. Well, all 500 of them actually needed to see the medical doctor as well, but they were preoccupied with needing to get their teeth fixed and their eyes fixed, which are not covered in so many cases under any kind of insurance plan.
Is it shocking to you to see this in the United States of America? I know you've done this work in the Amazon and elsewhere, but is it shocking to you see? I mean, I was by the images of rather abjectly miserable people who seem to have almost no other option than coming to your, out of the blue clinic set up at a gymnasium somewhere.
Well, and they're the same people that are coming every year, because we consistently go back to many of these places time and time again. And in fact, the program that you refer to on 60 Minutes was a relatively small operation for us. We did 920 people in a day and a half.
Wow.
That particular year, which was 2008, we went back to exactly the same place at exactly the same time early in 2009, and we did 910 people. They were the same people, so they depend on us for their source of health care.
Stan Brock is with us from Knoxville, Tennessee. We're talking today about extraordinary people doing extraordinary work out in the tough problems of this world. He's the founder of Remote Area Medical to bring medical services to the remote Amazon. Now they're doing it in the United States of America. Let's go to Wayne in Acton, Massachusetts. Wayne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and Dan. And I remember the program very well on 60 Minutes and a similar program with Bill Moyers on PBS. And obviously the volunteers who are delivering the services are to be lauded. But I think also the fact that we have that type of need in the United States represents such an incredible public policy failure in this country. And I can only hope that this debate going on week after week, month after month in Washington about health care, that some of the folks who are making those decisions are aware of what's happening. And I think it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace that in this nation we haven't done a better job in delivering health care to our population.
Wayne, thank you very much for your call. Stan Brock, what about the things you see at your clinics? Do you think the policymakers in Washington are aware of the level of need and distress out there?
Well, frankly, I think that in most cases they probably are not. This situation has prevailed over many, many, many decades. I think Theodore Roosevelt was the first person who started talking about fixing it. But there have been so many opportunities that that members of the administration and Congress have had to come and see one of these things in operation, where thousands of people are lined up. But to my knowledge, I must say the governor of several states have been to them and have been quite shocked by the turnout of people. You really have to be there. You have to be there and see people, whether it's snowing or raining or whether it's hot or dry, that for 12, 15, 24 hours they're lined up there just to get what you would think would be a right in this country, the world's richest country, to get the care that they need. And, back in 1944, at the height of World War II, there were 49.7 million inhabitants of Britain, of which I was one. And there was a great problem with the access to health care, and the government decided they were going to fix it. And it was a coalition bipartisan government, and they assigned an hour in Bevan to do the job. And that was the emergence of free health care for everybody in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And now fast forward 66 years, and you've got about the same number of people, 40-odd million, that don't have access to the system. And at least I think we've got to try
In the United States.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think at least we've got to try and fix it for those people anyway, and perhaps the world's finest medical technology and access for those people that can afford it perhaps can more or less remain the same. But let's take care of the 40-odd million that are desperate.
Stan Brock is the founder of Remote Area Medical. I'm struck again and again by the images I've seen of people coming to your clinic just by how abject they are in their need. A stoic, I mean, they want to do the right thing, but they need help. Here's a little bit of a one woman in search of new eyeglasses. This is Joanne Ford. She was one of the last to make it through the doors of a Knoxville clinic put on by Remote Area Medical. And she had found that the vision care line had closed by the time she got there, at the end of hundreds coming through. She talked with 60 Minutes reporter Scott Pelley here about the difficulties of obtaining health care on her disability income and not wanting to ask her friends for help.
I just hate to ask. I've worked all my life. I hate to ask. That's why things like this are so wonderful.
There is no shame in seeking health care.
No, you're right. You know, it really, I am sad that we are the wealthiest nation in the world and we don't take care of our own. So, but it will be okay.
It'll be okay, maybe. Maybe if you're lucky enough to get the service. Eric in Augusta, Georgia is calling. Hi, Eric. You're on the air with Stanley Brock.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Stanley. Years ago, I used to volunteer in California where they had similar health clinics would open up at night and on the weekends servicing particularly the Hispanic community, although nobody was turned away. Mm-hmm. And it was a very effective program, and I noticed that most of the people we seemed to treat were, in fact, children who were in dire need of all forms of medical care, suffering from things that we hadn't seen, some things that would turn you green if you did. But I was curious if Stanley's group is providing tailored translation for Hispanics that come through, and what percentage would you say of the people that he's seeing are recent Hispanic immigrants?
Interesting question. Stanley Brock.
Yeah, a very, very good question, because actually, historically, in this country, only 6.6% of the people that come to our free clinic are our children. Children have, generally speaking, access to much of the care that they need. But once they pass that threshold of 18 or 21 in some cases, they're on their own. And then things start to deteriorate with them. So that actually 83% of all the people we see are between the age of 29 and 64. And after that, of course, Medicare does provide some relief for them. But yet, several weeks ago, we were in one of the Native American reservations, and the percentage of children that came in the door was 41%.
And what about ethnicity, Hispanics, maybe recent arrivals to this country? I have to say, I don't know what you find in general. In the footage I saw from Knoxville, it looked very much like sort of a white working class Americans, but I don't know what your experience is more broadly.
Oh, well... many places that we go to, in Los Angeles, for example, New Orleans, it's 90-odd% African-American. And here in Appalachia, it's 90-odd% Caucasian. We do see a lot of Hispanic folks, but they are, in fact, except in a place like Los Angeles, very much in the minority, but we provide the same services for them. We don't ask any questions. It's first come, first served. And, of course, Remote Area Medical does not receive or want to receive any financing from the government or the taxpayer.
Let's go to Nathan in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Nathan, you're on the air with Stan Brock.
I love your program every time, especially today. I don't accept the premise that... Well, let me just condense it all, and I'll get your guys' thoughts. Mm-hmm. I think the government's always in the way. It takes so long for medicines to get to the market. They put so many obstacles in the way of doctors to practice medicine. And I'd actually thought of one good solution while I was waiting on the air is, provide tax breaks to doctors every year that give their time. Let the private sector take care of it. Private sector always does it better. And
Nathan, if you'd be kind enough, let me put that to Stan Brock. Our time is so short. Stanley Brock, you began citing the national health care system's development in the United Kingdom. Now Nathan says government's always in the way and maybe we should leave it to the private sector. What's your opinion in this country now?
Well, let me make one very important comment here, that the greatest impediment to what we do is the fact that for some extraordinary reason here in the United States, a doctor, dentist, nurse, even veterinarians – duly licensed and trained in one state are not allowed to cross state lines to provide free care to patients in need, except here in the state of Tennessee, where we changed the law. Now, there are 179,000 dentists and 800,000 physicians in this country, and thousands of them are willing to volunteer their time.
But should American healthcare rely on volunteers? I understand it's very important for your work, but as a national solution, should it be national healthcare, or should it be people depending on volunteers and the private sector? How do you see it?
Well, no. To go back to my earlier comment, I think that we've really got to have some kind of program to take care of the 40-odd million people that don't have access to the system. And then perhaps the rest of the country that are well insured or can afford the system, perhaps leave them the way they are. But we're talking about hundreds of thousands and indeed millions if this country was opened up so that doctors could provide free care to the uninsured and the unemployed by crossing state lines. This would make a really quite a sizable difference.
Where's your next clinic, Stan Brock?
The heart of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., at the end of January.
Do you have any idea how many people you expect to line up for free and needed medical care?
Well, with 28.3% unemployment in Ward 8 in the capital district, I would say probably about 1,500 people a day.
That's a lot, and that's just one example of the mission that you're up to. Stan Brock, founder of Remote Area Medical. We've been talking with extraordinary people doing extraordinary work on tough problems today. You are certainly one of those. We're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your comments and calls today as well, as we've looked out on people doing real work down in the weeds of addressing problems in this society of ours. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.